The BGRP Gaming Podcast, episode 46, recorded on December 11th, 2017. Welcome to the 486th edition of the Cheaty Gaming Podcast on the 319th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Fowle.
I am TJ Denzer.
I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So, we recorded an episode last week, but there were several problems with it. One was that it was divided in two because of equipment issues, but also it was kind of dull, and there wasn't much to talk about last week. And also, one of the items actually got a lot more expansive, so I figured we'd just redo the entire episode with some new news and expand on some of the news that actually was interesting last week. And there's a lot more information about it, as Scott can probably attest to, since he's probably been snapping up all the news about the expansion for Civ 6, like, as it comes out.
Yeah, I have been. They've been revealing some of the leaders that we're getting and the new Civs as well.
But we're going to discuss that. Yeah, we're going to discuss that a little bit later. In the meantime, what have you been playing, Scott?
I've been playing Quern, The Undying Thoughts. It basically plays like a Myst game where you're stranded, or you're kidnapped in this case, into this strange world, and you're trying to puzzle out what's going on with it. And it's this alien place, and you read these letters that are kind of guiding you along the way of your kidnapper, and he wants you to help him, but first he wants to show you all this cool stuff he's found, and so that way you understand his issue, whatever it is. I haven't gotten that far yet, but like I said, it plays like a Myst game, and you even get an in-game journal where you can make sketches and notes about the places and things you're seeing. So it's really a lot of fun.
So when you say Myst, you're saying it's a 3D adventure game? And for those of you who don't know, Myst is, the way you spell it is M-Y-S-T.
Yeah, it's a 3D adventure game, and you're moving in real time while you move around. So it's not those painting movements. So it's like the later Myst games.
Well, the tech, back when Myst was released, I don't know, was it 1998, 1997, something like that? All they could do were 3D portraits, so that when it was sort of like using Google Maps. Google Maps, you know, using Google Maps. It was sort of like that.
Is it a puzzle-heavy game?
Yes, definitely. You have to figure out the puzzles, and like there was one puzzle where you see a combination lock, but you don't see where the key is, and you have to go around finding these other items that will reveal to you where the combination is. And there's this paper that you find. It tells you a couple of strange symbols with some numbers, but then you have to find the thing that deciphers that, and basically you find this orange, and you find on the table this orange crystal that shines through a lens into a blue that reveals this hidden paint, kind of like a phosphorus paint. If you put light near it, it glows up. Well, then you got to find the device that'll light up the room that shows you where the invisible paint is, that shows you the combination to unlock the lock. And it's really a lot of fun.
What was the name of the game again?
Quern. I think it's Q-U-E-R-Y-N. Q-E-R-Y-N.
Cool. So what have you been playing, TJ?
I've been working my way through Nier Automata.
Otherwise, the Game Awards, Zelda game.
The Game Awards, a soundtrack award winning Nier Automata.
By the way, the awards were released. Zelda got best game, but Cuphead got a crap ton of awards.
Uh huh. A lot of people felt like Cuphead should have got the soundtrack, but I'm sitting here being someone who isn't fully in love with Nier Automata, but has played through a good portion of it by this point. I get it. It's got a soundtrack that I can play whether I'm in the game, or actually I've been listening to some of the music while I've been working, And it's one of those things where, like, a lot of the songs have like just instrumental, but then some of them have vocal formats to them. And I like that because when I'm working, when I'm writing, I can't have music that has words to it or else it distracts me from my line of words.
I'm going to tell you something. And Cuphead's music doesn't have words, but it's definitely going to distract you.
Yeah.
I mean, it really has an aggressive big band sound.
Yeah, it's that swinging jazz, that liveliness. It really is like another character in the game. But I really like Nier Automata. I've ragged on it a couple times before, and those things still annoy me about it. There are certain times when it pulls the camera control away from you and puts it in really annoying positions.
Like behind your ass?
No, that's like actually the hardest camera angle to get. That's actually the hardest camera angle to get, which is why it's an achievement in the game. Really? But
that developers are mostly male?
I think it's all in good fun, just because people made such a big deal about it that how could you not make that a thing after everybody got the internet exploded and get all mad over it?
I remember people used to with the original Tomb Raider managed to get the camera to focus on her blocky tits.
Uh huh.
They weren't breasts. They were just basically two polygons.
Pyramids.
But yeah, I get why people really love Nier Automata. There's a lot going on in there. There's a lot of fun to it. It hits me in a lot of certain ways that Final Fantasy XV did, which I enjoyed the journey in that game. I guess I would say that it's like it's an 8 out of 10 most of the time, except for those times where it forgets it's an 8 out of 10 and suddenly turns into a 2 out of 10 camera handling an 8 out of 10 game.
I don't know. You know, it's 2017. You'd figure that they'd know how to correctly have a smarter camera these days.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about Nier Automata. I'm talking about all third-person games.
Yeah. And it's just like, it's these moments where, like, it's purposeful. There's these moments where it just, like, pulls you out to, like, a top-down view, sort of like a bullet hell shooter, or like, I don't know.
There's a top-down like, shooter. I mean, these would be a metric.
Or a side-scroller. Or a side-scroller. And I hate, like, I like those games, but I don't like Nier pretending to try to be those games. I like Nier being Nier, where I can, like, get lost in, like, the music and get lost in 2B's butt and get lost in and some action-packed swordplay. And it bugs me when the game, like, reminds me that it's a game by doing that with the camera.
Yeah. I think I talked about this last week. I've been playing Madden because I got it on sale. And I wish I'd gotten a different game on sale because Madden Out and Out sucks. And one of the things we discussed last week is that one of the reasons is that there is no competition for it. EA Sports' best game is probably FIFA. And I think that's because they have to deal with Konami and Pro Evolution Soccer, right? I mean, if you have someone else pushing you, then you're going to try and do better. And what really bothers me is that all the positive scores for Madden from reviewers. And I know why, because here's the thing. They don't take sports games seriously at major gaming sites because basically, and I know this is a blanket statement, but a lot of video game reviewers don't like sports in general. They don't care. Now you were going to
see, and I know. Jay. See, and I know some people who reviewed that game, and they genuinely enjoy it, but your big problem with it is that, like, there are certain parts of it that are just stupidly unrealistic, right? Like,
it's not unrealistic, it's just plain bad. I mean, the franchise mode has no features. The so-called career mode, it's a telltale game. You don't really do anything in it, you know? I mean, when you have stuff like Road to the Show, and MLB The Show, and other games in which the career mode actually means you get to play this with this character throughout a career. You actually get to play the game from that perspective. You know, in Madden, it's just a third-rate story that that has no surprises. You can guess the ending of it immediately. And the bulk of it is, okay, we want you to, it's like Simon Says at one point. He's going to read out a play, you have to repeat it. I didn't do a career mode to do a memory game. I didn't do it for QuickTime events. You know? I want to choose my position, I want to choose, you know, and I want to, you know, have a play. It's just a mess. And the gameplay isn't all that good either. As a matter of fact, it's detracted. And if you don't own an Xbox One X, the graphics actually suck, and they have gotten worse. And it reminds me of what happened with EA's golf game, Tiger Woods Golf, on the Wii. That was, they were just porting two-year-old PC games for it.
Yeah.
It's just bad, you know?
Well, that's a shame. Did you play anything good?
Well, I've started playing, well, I don't know if you consider it good or not. I've been playing Fallout 4 again, and it's one of those games in which every time I get angry at it, certain things happen that make me love it all over again. It's one of those games in which you can't stay mad at it, because there are so many things that are good in it that, you know, a lot of the things that are bad, and I'm not even talking about bugs, I'm just talking about general design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm discovering new things in it. You know, and that's one of the marks of a game. You know, I'm coming back to a two-year-old game, and I'm discovering new things that I didn't even know were in the game. And I'm not one of those guys who goes into facts and wikis, you know, to find out all the secrets. I don't play that way, you know. I still haven't met Strong, and I know Strong is a character.
Uh-huh.
I still haven't met Kiri, and I know she's a character.
Kiri is the best character.
And you know what's the interesting thing? If I want to get the DLC, I have to pay $50, but they have a Game of the Year edition of Fallout 4 that I can get for $30.
That's always been a weird thing when, like, certain, like the DLC doesn't necessarily keep up retroactively with the Game of the Year releases or other releases that come out.
Yeah. I've been playing here. Go ahead.
So you'll have things like, you know, Neo, which by this year has come out with a Game of the Year edition, a complete edition for all the systems and PC, and that has all the DLC on it. But if you go in there and like look at the DLC by itself, I think they're still about $20 a piece.
I mean, you have to, Far Harbor costs $25. Still.
Fallout 4 was one of the games that was optimized for Xbox One X, yeah?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, there's some news that we're not using, that the VR version is coming out soon.
So, you have an Xbox One X.
Yeah.
What do you think of the graphical upgrades for it?
They made it so that it's sharp in 4K. I don't know if the textures are really all that different to me, but it's crisp. And I think Bethesda is more paying more attention to making it VR than they are to making, you know, really great textures, you know. And I will say, you know, it does look better. It doesn't look phenomenally better like some games do. Like Halo 5 looks phenomenally better, you know. But I can't find jaggies, even if I'm close to the TV, unless I'm looking at it in an angle. But then again, you shouldn't be looking at an angle on TV. So there's that. I've also been poking into Injustice 2, waiting for the new DLC to come out, and poking into A Shadow of War. And the thing that I found out, which really bugs the hell out of me, is that you can only have one save file. If you want to start a new game, a new campaign, you have to start all over, and you have to delete what you've already accomplished, which bugs the hell out of me.
That's the stupidest thing.
Yeah, I hate that.
Every Pokemon game ever.
They just need to allow for multiple save slots so you can have your alternating save points. And especially if you're like a YouTuber that does game videos, they like to be able to restore to certain points to get game footage. And, you know, if you're just one of those players that wants to try different things and or messes up and has to go back a few saves or something, it's just
The real problem is that they're including new content, you know, and while you can deal with, say, the Slaughter Tribe after you've completely finished the game, it's not as fun as if they're already incorporated into the game from the start. So what I think is going to happen is I'm going to wait until all the DLC comes out, and then I'm going to replay it from scratch again.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a thing for a long time. And like, I play games with my wife all the time. We're playing through Nier right now, and we're playing through Wolfenstein as well. One of the things I like to do with that game, because she goes to work and I'm home by myself, I like to play through the game and go on my own time, and then go back to another save when she's around. And I can't stand games that do that crap where they, like, I mean, it's such an archaic thing. I get why Pokemon Red and Blue did it on the original Game Boy, because they didn't have hardware space to include several saves. But there is no reason why Pokemon games released in 2017 shouldn't allow you to have more than one save. It's just a stupid archaic.
The reason for that is very simple. They save games. They don't want people to trade in their games.
It's an archaic design thing made for the sheer nostalgia of archaic design, and I freaking hate it.
Yeah,
I hate it too. And I've seen RPGs with save games on them turned into game stores to be bought. I mean, people did return. It wasn't a deterrent to stopping them trading in their games just because they had saves on there.
Yeah. So you want to get really angry now? Because we're going to start with the news, and this one isn't exactly directly related to video game news, but it does affect it, and it does affect my future plans. And the first news item is Patreon service fees anger creators and patrons, and this comes to us from Engadget, sort of, kind of. I had to choose which article to do. I was tempted to use Polygon's article, but I'm using this one from Engadget because it has some of the stuff that is really important to giving an idea of how this hurts people. So this past week, the popular patronage system Patreon made an announcement that has shaken its user base to the core. It is implementing a fee charge that will change that will gut the current pledge system and is already devastating people who rely on it to support their creative endeavors. If you're unfamiliar with Patreon, it's a service that allows individual people to financially support creators, such as webcomics authors, writers, podcasters, and YouTube stars. Rather than a service like PayPal or Venmo, which offers one-time payments, Patreon operates on a per-month basis. Supporters pledge a certain amount per month, $1 the minimum, and their cards are automatically charged at the beginning of the month for the amount they've committed across the platform. Obviously, Patreon takes a cut, which is how it makes money. Until now, it's been a pretty simple, no-frill system that many people in the creative fields have taken advantage of. However, this week, Patreon introduced new changes that turns all of this upside down. On Wednesday, the service sent a mail to creators outlining changes to the fee structure of pledges. Rather than extracting the processing fee from the creator's side, Patreon is going to start charging the supporters extra. This new service fee is 2.9% plus 35% per pledge. It's effective on December 18th for new pledges and as of January 1st for existing ones. Additionally, patrons will now be charged individually on the date of their pledge anniversary rather than in bulk at the beginning of the month. $1 pledges make up the backbone of Patreon. Generally speaking, people have a limited amount they're able to pledge and of their own money. There's no limit that you can spend on Patreon. And rather than spending, say, $10 to one thing, they will often send $1 to 10 different projects they want to support. This new fee structure will wreak havoc on that system. Every $1 pledge will cost patrons $1.38 under this new model. Small donors are, in essence, going to pay 38% more under this new system. This change incentivizes bigger individual pledges. One $10 pledge will now cost the supporter $10.64 per month, while 10 $1 pledges will cost $13.80. This change will gut the $1 and perhaps the $5 economy on Patreon. Now, someone else noted that they had $69 spread across 50 Patreons. With that, they're going to be spending $23.80 extra per month, essentially making it $100 instead of $70. After the backlash, Patreon updated its announcement post to address some of its users' concerns and explain the fee charge further. The team claims that creators and patrons both found old payment system incredibly confusing, which resulted in thousands of support tickets from confused customers. Right off, I'm going to drop myself and say bullshit. The fee structure was also unclear. A 5% percent fee from Patreon, plus a processing fee that ranged from 2% to 10% from a third party. I'm going to tell you who that third party is. That is PayPal. Because what someone found out with a graph is that a lot of this is Patreon paying PayPal for processing fees. Patreon has positioned this change as a benefit to creators, that their announcement email had the subject line, creators will now take home exactly 95%, which is true. But creators have petitioned, they wanted, well, why don't you make it on our side rather than the consumer side? And they said, nope. The other thing is that Patreon pissed off a whole lot of people by saying, well, here's the thing. We want to support the major Patreons. You know, the smaller Patreons aren't as profitable to us, which really angered a lot of people. Basically, they were saying, we don't care about the small Patreons. You only want the large ones, ignoring the fact that a lot of those small Patreons became big Patreons. And what they're essentially saying is, we want whales. But what they don't understand is that whales live on plankton. You know? For example, Ryan North, the writer of Marvel's The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl and creator of the popular webcomic Dinosaur Comics, told Engadget that in November he had 734 Patreons. He has 687 now. 53%, or 392 of them, were at $1 or less, and 278 of them are at the $3 level. That's a whopping 91% of his supporters.
Yeah, this is a big mess. This is Patreon creating a problem where there was none and then trying to answer it.
Yeah, but the other thing is that someone else noted that they had committed something like $300 million to something in order to back that, because that was at like 64% change, and they had to do this. The other thing is that I forgot his name, but the creator of Patreon seemed to forget why people were going to Patreon. The reason is that they were not making any money from YouTube. And when YouTube started changing its policies, a lot of people went to Patreon so that they could get more direct payment from their fans. So by emulating YouTube, they're basically making the same mistake. And now there's something called Kickstarter Drip, which is in beta right now, that people are looking to as a replacement. Because as we know, Kickstarter is basically a one-time, you know, what's it called, crowdfunding thing, you know. You donate your money and you get at the end of the crowdfunding, and Kickstarter Drip was basically going to be like Patreon. And
yeah, but the super fucked up thing is that Patreon was good as it was, and like I sagely enough, one of my friends was like, there's not going to be another thing like Patreon so soon, and really we shouldn't trust that there's going to be another thing like Patreon so soon. I mean,
well, here's the thing. Someone else started their own thing, which didn't depend on Patreon either, in which they set up their web page to allow people to make contributions, and it would be regulated by the site, and what it would do is basically interact with PayPal directly. So basically what happens is that people subscribe and the creator would not deal with Patreon. They would just basically have the money go to PayPal automatically and let PayPal take their cut rather than having to go through a middle source. So Patreon is basically kneecapping itself. One thing that's sort of related is VidMe is gone now, which was the alternative to YouTube, which is depressing as well. I mean, this is a monopoly and nothing's been done about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean,
isn't there like a Justin TV and Blip TV? What happened to those?
Yeah, Blip TV vanished like a couple of years ago. Yeah. Which is why people went to Patreon, because it was basically, well, you know, these video services aren't going to pay us much. You know, the founder of Patreon had a music video that earned 12 million hits, but he only made like $500 off it or something like that. So he wanted more, so he created a Patreon. And there are posts on Twitter from people, from these Patreon creators, who are showing everybody who's just dropping the service. You know,
yeah.
People.
And the worst thing about that is that even if Patreon were to like suddenly decide, oh, we found our conscience, we're going to go back to the way it was, there's a good portion of those users that aren't going to come back. And that's the thing that really sucks, is that the damage is done and it's irreversible on some levels.
I mean, some Patreons are suspending payments rather than, you know, some of them are leaving. Some of them are suspending payments, telling their fans, okay, you know what? Right now, we're going to not take any payments. We're going to do this for free for a little bit until this mess is settled.
I know people that can't do that. I know artists that literally live by their Patreon support per month.
Those are a small percentage of Patreon. Most people who are on Patreon do it as a supplementary income, basically to fund their hobbies. It's not like this is their job. You know, basically it's sort of so that they can continue to do it. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot, like TJ said, there are some who really can't function without it, you know. And it's like, people are going to find a way, you know, because here's the thing. Creators aren't going to go away. They're just going to look for ways to make money. And if they have to do it directly through PayPal donations, that's been the way they've done it for 20 years. Not necessarily PayPal donations, but just here's this button, click on it, send us money, you know. But the problem with that, of course, is that, you know, you have to remind people. And a lot of people may ignore it and just do it anyway and just enjoy your work without doing it, you know, because it's basically PBS. So yeah, it's a huge mess, and we're going to see what happens with Kickstarter Drip, because that it all depends on how here's the thing about Kickstarter Drip. Don't think they're blind. They know what's going on. And whatever plans they may have had with Kickstarter Drip, they may adjust those plans.
And just, yeah, no doubt.
And here's the thing. Like I said, the Patreons are willing to take the extra fees unto themselves, right? And not penalize the... But here's the other thing, by the way. One thing that we haven't discussed yet is that not having it one large lump at the beginning of the month really hurts patrons, because there are credit card fees per charge.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to have 14 charges in the middle of the month instead of just one big one, that's going to add up big time, too. And you have those hidden costs as well.
Yeah. Thankfully, I've only got one, so I won't see too much of a problem. But I know plenty of people that spread out their donations because they have a lot of people they want to – they have a lot of people they admire, and they want to support them somehow. And that's cool, and they should be able to do that without fucking having to deal with – It's a mess. Like, I don't know how everything is seemingly going fine, and then one day a freaking executive wakes up and realizes, I'm going to screw half my fan base today.
It's like these executives are not getting enough money somehow, and they need to earn more. And I really feel bad for these YouTubers who, you know, first YouTube is screwing them over by demonetizing their stuff, and now Patreon is screwing them over by changing the lowest tiers for donation for the Patreons. And it's just, it just feels like this bubble is starting to pop, and I feel bad. And because this was a really interesting way for people to make a living and do video creation, which was not really something you could do. I mean, in the past, it was like you had to be discovered or something to make movies and have people see them, or
people
at least get paid for it anyways.
People like Jim Sterling are hurt the most, because Jim does not monetize his YouTube videos. So he doesn't have to worry about, you know, people doing copyright claims on it, because it's not going to hurt him directly, even if they shut down his channel. You know, which always fails because, you know, fair use, and he has enough clout to be able to get lawyers to end all that. But he does depend on Patreon and donations, which allows him. And we remember a couple of months back, maybe 2 months ago, remember that YouTube started, closing channels that asked for Patreons in their descriptions. If you did not have if you did not monetize your video, I think it was, but you listed a Patreon link, they would just shut the video down.
Oh.
That's really lame.
Very lame.
So,
because there's a few YouTubers I watch that list their Patreons at the end of their video to thank them, and so it's obviously in there that they want people to use Patreon, and that's their main source of income.
Yeah, Vimeo is still around, but Vimeo is not much better than YouTube. So, we're going to move on to the next item, and Scott, you can take this one.
Alrighty then. Civilization VI, Rise and Fall announced. This is from Firaxis. In a press release, Civ 6 lead designer Anton Stranger revealed some of the big changes coming with a huge Civilization VI expansion, Rise and Fall. The biggest overarching goal, dynamic empires, great ages. As your civilization ebbs and flows, you reach milestone historic moments. You will experience dark ages or golden ages. Each provides specific challenges and bonuses based on your actions in game. Rise triumphantly from a dark age, and your next golden age will be even stronger, a heroic age. Loyalty. Cities now have the individual loyalty to your leadership. Let it fall too low, and you face the consequences of low yields, revolts, and potential to lose your city to another civilization or its own independence. But one civilization's loss can be your gain as you inspire loyalty among cities throughout the map and further expand your borders. Governors. Recruit, appoint, and upgrade powerful characters with unique specialization bonuses and promotion trees that customize your cities and reinforce loyalty. Enhanced alliances. An enhanced alliance system allows players to form different types of alliances and build bonuses over time. Emergencies. When a civilization grows too powerful, other civilizations can join a pact against the threatening civilization and earn rewards or penalties when emergency ends. Timeline. Review your civilization's history at any time with the new timeline feature, a visual journey through historic moments that you encountered on your path to victory. New leaders and civs. 9 leaders and 8 new civilizations are introduced. Each brings unique bonuses and gameplay, as well as a total of 8 unique units, 2 unique buildings, 4 unique improvements, and 2 unique districts. New global content. 8 new world wonders, 7 natural wonders, 4 new units, 2 new tile improvements, 2 new districts, 14 new buildings, 3 resources have been added. Improved gameplay systems. The government system has been enhanced with new policies and additional improvements that have been made to the existing systems. The first civ announced is Korea under Seondeok, and following wonders were revealed. The Statue of Liberty, St. Basil's Cathedral, Temple of Artemis, Archive of the Indies, a giant Buddha, possibly the Great Buddha of Kamakura, a polar research station, possibly Amundsen, Scout South Pole Station. It could be a now snow exclusive district of some kind. Now I know there's one of the new districts is a government district, so don't think it's that. It hasn't been in any screenshots, but Chateau Frontiac was spotted in Rise and Fall's title card right next to the Statue of Liberty. Natural wonders include Mount Romeria, 4 tiles, a delicate arch, 1 tile has been seen, as well as unidentified four-tile tundra wonder. There's also the redwood forest has been shown, and there's also a picture of a Dutch leader for a female leader. I forgot her name, but we're getting the Dutch, and there'll be another female leader. There's a lot of speculation on what the next civs are going to be shown. Probably like Genghis for the Mongols and Suleiman for the Ottomans.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those $40 expansions. This is going to be huge.
Yeah, I think it's $30 right now. It's not even on sale, and I think it's probably going to be around $30. But yeah, this is huge. Being able to flip cities again, being able to have a timeline, Dark Ages against Golden Ages. There's a lot of new stuff here that's going to be fun to explore, and it's going to make it a different game, pretty much.
You know, governors we've seen in games like Mass of Orion, in which you just hire leaders and assign them to either ships or colonies. I think this is going to be the same way. I mean, in the past, governors were basically, I don't want to deal with this city. Let me just have the AI handle building stuff in it. This one is more like it's going to have effects, you know, percentages added to that city. You know, you can have a governor who, you know, specializes in military output. So you get bonuses to when you build military units there.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. There'll be like maybe a tax collecting governor or something like that to help increase gold revenues. So I'm very interested to see how well that mechanic works. Because in the past it was just, you know, pretty much here's your production governor, here's your culture governor, and you just click it and they do their thing and you might queue up some buildings or whatever, but it was very abstracted. This will be more involving. And again, there's more resources. I think they're putting gold as a land resource back in the game now. That was weird not having it there, but now it's back, and I think amber is being put in. And
well, Statue of Liberty was a wonder in previous games.
Oh, yeah. In Civ 4, I think. Yeah, it was definitely Civ 4 and Civ 5.
Oh, no, I remember in Civ, I think it was 3, in which Statue of Liberty could grant you democracy, no matter who you were. Something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Might have even been in Civ 1 and 2. It's been so long.
Yeah. The other thing is, what's interesting to note is that Civ 4 and Civ 5 had expansions because their base game felt incomplete. You know, they felt... Remember when we first got Civ 4, and especially when we first got Civ 5, they felt like half a game had been released, you know, and they didn't really feel meaty, yeah. And the expansions were necessary. Civ 6 came out of the gate feeling complete. And this
yes,
is an
I agree.
That's going to make it feel more complete.
Yeah, it feels like it's expanding on what's already there as opposed to filling in what's missing and should have been there. Like espionage wasn't in Civ 5 when it first came out. So when it was Gods and Kings, you got espionage back, and it was really good to be able to use spies again.
TJ?
Yeah, everything here looks like This is phenomenally good as far as like an expansion goes. There's a lot of stuff. And I mean, 9 civilizations? That's like an entire new game worth of civilizations. Because where do we start with? Like 14 in the base game?
Something like that, I think. And then they added more.
Yeah, they added a crap ton more. Especially if you were like me and you bought, I think it was the $99 thing in which you got all the DLC for free.
The digital deluxe edition, yeah.
Now, one of the other things is that one of the new techs or new abilities is Pike and Shot, which is a new combat thing, which is really going to add. It comes with metal casting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen that ability, so I don't know. I'll tell you, see them in-game.
Okay, so... Pike and Shot is a new anti-cavalry unit, bridging the long, awkward gap between pikemen and anti-tank. 3 more units have been added to the late game to cap off lines that previously ended too soon. You'll have the supply convoy, an upgraded version of the medic that can increase movement speed of units that it shares a tile with. In addition to restoring HP, you have Spec Ops, which is a Navy SEAL-inspired unit that caps off the line for the humble scout, gaining the ability to paradrop forward without use of aircraft. And the drone, which is the upgraded version of the observation balloon. Now, you already mentioned this before. You have the government district. There can only be one of these in your entire Civ. And it interacts directly with the upgraded government system. Based on your current government type, you'll be able to build a number of new buildings in your government district, each of which unlocks policy cards, which is interesting, too. And I think that could be potentially very powerful. The one thing... Scott, what do you think before I go on?
I do like the government district idea. It's kind of like having your Forbidden Palace. You might be able to build your second capital kind of thing or your backup capital. And I do like that you can unlock stuff with it. And I want to see what else you can build in it. And yeah, I think it's a good idea.
The only danger I see is, of course, feature creep. You know, you have all this stuff coming into the game. But on the other hand, you know, here's the thing about Civ 6. It's the first game that was really made by that was really a fan game, because while the other games have been made, like Soren Johnson, they were fans of the game, but the people who are coming into Civ 6 are like people from Apolliton and Turncast coming in and deciding to make their own version of Civ 6. You know, it has that, Civ 6 has that feeling of, this is the greatest hits of Civilization, and this is what the fans want. So the only problem I might have is that there's going to be feature creep, but it also sounds like they're taking a lot of time making sure that nothing is broken. Well, hopefully nothing will be broken.
Yeah. They definitely have been taking their time, I think, and trying to make sure that bugs are fixed and things are balanced properly in the game.
Also, for, you know, I would like a way to kill apostles and missionaries who are coming in to try and convert your cities. I want some way to kill them without having to do those stupid little battles. Like there's a policy that allows one of your soldiers to come up and shoot them.
Yeah. Or at least just keep them out of your borders.
Yeah. Well, there is one tech that allows you to I forgot what it was, but it always gave every apostle a certain ability that they, you know, I know there's one that says that you can, there's whenever you lose a religious battle, your faith never goes down. I know that's one of the policies that you can have for your religions, but there was another one that just made sure that your apostles just kicked everybody's ass if they came into your civ. Anyways, it just is the one thing that makes me want to throw the computer out the window. I wish there was a way to turn off religion sometimes in the game. You know, just so I could have a straight civ experience without having to worry about these guys wandering in and deciding to convert my cities. Of course, now we have the danger of people just not only converting your cities, but just taking them. Just offering a lot of money and saying, hey, come over to us.
Yeah, the city flipping is going to be... That's something I didn't like in Civ 4, where the culture border would just enwrap your cities and flip them, and you could actually abuse it to the point where you could flip the entire civilization.
The culture bomb is back now, so you will have those culture bombs.
Yeah, that's not going to be fun.
I prefer that to, you know, having these guys wandering in and converting my cities. It's just annoying because. You can't, you know, they go through units except for other, you know, of its type. It's just like, anyways, TJ, take the next item.
Sure. Bungie admits we've made mistakes, from PC Gamer. Quite a number of Destiny 2 players were disappointed last week when they discovered that some of the things they were using, Quite a number of Destiny 2 players were disappointed last week when they discovered that some of the things they used to do in the game were no longer doable, because they'd been locked by the increased level cap that came with the Curse of Osiris expansion. Not owning the expansion means not having access to things like the Prestige Leviathan raid or the Trials of the Nine mode. These exclusions felt particularly egregious given that both activities were part of the base game, and the controversy also came on the heels of multiple other Bungie missteps. Today the dev team took to the Bungie blog to acknowledge mistakes that have been made. The Prestige Raid was a novel experience that players value, even if they don't own Curse of Osiris, and it was a mistake to move that experience out of reach. Throughout the lifetime of the Destiny franchise, Trials has always required that players owned the latest expansion. However, for Destiny 2, Trials of the Nine launched as part of the main game, so it's not right for us to remove access to it, Bungie wrote. To make matters worse, our team overlooked the fact that both of these mistakes disabled trophies and achievements for Destiny 2. This was an unacceptable lapse on our part, and we cannot understand the frustration, it has created. To rectify the issues outlined, a hotfix is coming later this week following the scheduled maintenance. Other aspects of the change are considerably kludgy. Other aspects of the chamber are considerably kludgier. However, Trials of the Nine events will only require Curse of Osiris ownership when it features Curse of Osiris maps. For other weeks, it will be available to everyone. new seasonal rewards that launched with the expansion will not be available to players that don't own it. However, the same goes for standard Nightfalls. When a Curse of Osiris map is running, it will require the expansion, and when it's not, it won't. Time-limited events, Iron Banner, Faction Rallies, and the Dawning, will be open to everyone. But again, rewards that launched with the Curse of Osiris will require ownership of the expansion to be earned.
So you're the Destiny 2 player here, TJ.
Not anymore. I stopped.
Good for you, TJ.
I stopped before this became an issue. I feel bad because I spent money on the game, but I stopped.
You invested
I don't understand this idea of moving stuff from the base game to the expansion. I don't understand why they thought that was a good idea.
Well, it's that they released new content in certain modes for the expansion without realizing that a lot of events in Destiny 2 run on timers. So you'll have a certain map that plays for a certain amount of time on a certain mode, or you'll have a raid that opens during a certain time, like either over the weekend or maybe during a certain time, and you have to do it during that time period. And if it's a map that comes from the expansion, that obviously means that other people that haven't bought the expansion pass or the DLC don't get to access it, which is dumb.
I mean, Dungeon Defenders allows only, and there's a lot of games that do this, only need one player to own an expansion in order for other people to enjoy it. As a matter of fact, I remember a lot of Nintendo DS games that had multiplayer that only required one person to own the actual game.
Yeah, it was, I forget what they called it. It was like DS SharePlay or something like that.
I think it was called DS Link.
But it would be like if you were playing Pillars of Eternity and then they added an expansion and there was something in that expansion that tied into the end of the game, and so if you didn't have the expansion you couldn't play the end of the game, which is silly.
Actually,
why would you
actually it kind of did. There was a in the expansion you could get these allies to help you in your fight for your fort that you made.
That's different.
And if you didn't play the expansion, you didn't get those allies. You could still save your fort.
That's different. That's just having additional content that you paid for. And by the way, it's a single player game.
This would be like you don't get to save your fort no matter what because you don't have the expansion.
And the thing is that you have groups of friends who play an online game together. And all of them have to have the same expansion if they all want to continue playing with each other.
Yeah, that was Civ 5.
Yeah, so that was...
Because remember, here's the thing. I never really associated multiplayer with Civ, even if you could do multiplayer with Civ, but it started with 5.
Yeah.
It started in full with 5. Actually, I remember Civ 4 Network Edition.
But Civ 4, we were playing multiplayer, and I think Civ 3 too. People were playing that.
Yeah, that was limited though. Civ 3 was really limited.
Yeah,
especially because Civ 3 had the was it the one that only had hot seat in multiplayer? And by the way, I mean online multiplayer was hot seat, so you had to wait for everybody to do their turn before you could do yours instead of everybody doing their turn.
Yeah, Civ 4 had that. I remember that. We did a diplomacy game like that.
This isn't even really that good of a fix, because basically what it means is, like, if I'm invested in playing Destiny but I don't want to buy the expansion, I might log in on a day and it's like, oh, they're doing Curse of Osiris stuff on some of my modes today. Guess I'm not playing Destiny because Bungie decided I'm not playing Destiny.
You know, one of the things I wanted to say before with the entire Patreon thing, and I never got to say it, was that a lot of these owners, like the owner of Patreon, don't seem to understand that no one is required to play their game. No one required to pay, And if you're gonna screw up the prices, people are gonna say, "Well, I don't need you. Bye-bye." You know, it's not like they're gonna shell out money and say, "Oh, we need this so badly. We need to pay this extra money, or else." You know, they just say, "Oh, well, that's a shame. I'm goodbye." And the same thing with Destiny 2. I mean, people will just say, "Oh, that's a shame. Goodbye."
You think Destiny 2 was the only good game to come out in 2017? 2017 was awesome for games. I'll play something else.
You know?
Yeah, Destiny 2 is nowhere near the kind of game I'm even interested in. So it's like, no big deal. I just play something else.
That reminds me, by the way, PUBG is about to be launched on Xbox One.
Yes. Yes,
and
it is.
The thing is, I was looking at this article, and here's the thing that I did not know about PUBG as much, but now I do know, is that it's very heavy on console commands. You know, you really have to do a lot of consoles. You know, and when you're doing on a gamepad, it's like tons and tons of things. You have to press the left button in order to do this, and the right button to do this, and then you have this wheel, and then you have to do all this inventory management, you know. And one of the things I like about it, by the way, is that there's no aim assist.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because, you know, combat is a very small part of PUBG, really. It's the setting up. It's the preparing for combat. That's the main bulk of PUBG. You know, so aim assist isn't necessary. Inventory management is the biggest thing about PUBG.
Mm-hmm. Setting traps.
And then you have this, and you have all these, the author said that it took him four rounds to figure out how to do all of the stuff with a controller, you know. But on the other hand, you know, people, it's the sort of thing that's going to attract a lot of people, you know. I mean, how many first-person multiplayer shooters can you say are strategy games?
Very few, but at least a handful. Fortnite.
But Fortnite's not free yet, so.
The Battle Royale, I think, is.
PUBG is going to be huge on console. It's just going to dominate. It's already dominated PC. It's going to dominate console, too. And it looks beautiful, too, by the way. If you play on an Xbox One X, it's stunning. The water effects are right up there with computers. They're like upper mid-range computer stuff.
Nice.
So anyways, the last news item, and this is from last week, new Game Boy game released, and this comes to us from Kotaku. Tangrim Games has released a new title for the Game Boy, and by the way, when you say Game Boy, we mean Game Boy Classic, called Tobu Tobu Girl. You can download it and play it on your PC via an emulator, or if you prefer to do things the old-fashioned way, you can buy a boxed copy that includes a copy and cartridge and a manual. According to Tangram, your cat is floating into the atmosphere, and the only way you can save it is jump, dash, and flap your arms to maneuver around perilous obstacles, racing the clock to retrieve your pet friend before it's too late. You know, most popular games seem to say, you know, if we really want to make a game popular, we have to make it cat-themed.
Yeah, there's a Neko Atsumi, that's mobile game that came out where you literally just collect cats, and that thing was all everyone on my Twitter talked about for probably about a year.
Now,
there's
just, you know,
Cat Quest.
It's a limited number of carts. And here's the thing, I think it's really cool that you have something that's being released on an original Game Boy cart. You know, that to me is really nice. And the Game Boy officially stopped production, I believe, in 1999? No, 2000. It's 17 years since, I think. I'm going to look this up on Wikipedia. I know it's been a long, long time before anything was produced for the Game Boy. The original Game Boy.
It is cool to see these homebrew classic games. And I know I saw one, Little Medusa was made for NES, and so it's like a new retro classic game being made for an original.
Can you really call
console
a new game for retro console a retro game?
If it's a style.
You can call it a retro style game.
You can't even call it a retro style game if it's for the actual, I mean, here's the thing. There was a Kickstarter like a few years ago that someone did to bring Star Castles to the 2600 with actual 2600 carts. Now, while you could call it a retro game, it's not a retro game. It's just using the text for the retro console. So it's a new game for a retro console, and there has to be a term for that. I'm not going to accept retro, R-E-T-R-E-A-U-X, which some people do. It was like faux retro.
I mean, the only thing I can think of is Retro Style, which
classic style. It's not even Retro Style.
It's an actual game, though. There's nothing retro about it. It's just a new game that's using the old old tech.
I mean, to a certain degree, I mean, I think they made N64 I think they actually made N64 cartridges of Yooka-Laylee, but that was also released on a whole bunch of different systems. So, like,
Game Boy didn't come with a backlight?
Yes. Yeah, that you had that contrast switch on the side that you had to fiddle with when you had the certain light.
And all these third-party things that added a backlight.
Like, literally, like a little a Nintendo brand reading lamp.
Or one of those things that actually went over the screen itself.
Like, literally, like one of those little clips that you'd put on the top of a book, but it was Nintendo brand.
Yeah. You had to wait for the Game Boy Light.
Retro definition is imitative of a style, fashion, or design from the recent past. So I guess if it's not an imitation and it actually is, then I guess you're right, it's not retro. So I would say definitely like a classic style then.
Yeah, I mean,
an original.
It's like making a Slender Man game for a Game Boy Advance, right? It's there was no Slender Man mythos in 1989, right? But it is using the graphics for that card. I just, you know, here's the thing. If you have a dusty old Game Boy and it's people are making new games for it, you know, it's sort of like, hey, guess what? I'm going to dust it off and I'm going to pop a new card in it. And it's like having a new game on your old console. There's something strangely satisfying about that. It's like, yeah, my Game Boy is not dead. There's new stuff coming out for it.
The satisfying ka-chunk of locking a cartridge into your Game Boy.
Or your NES, or your Super Nintendo, or your Atari 2600. Anyways. So, did we have I think we had a question of the week last week. I don't know, but here's the thing, is that next week we're going to be doing our Games of the Year, you can create your own categories. I'm probably going to go with the usual best console, best Xbox One console game, best PS4 game, best strategy game, best action game, you know that. But you can create any sort of categories that you want, you know, like game that wasted my money the most.
I think last year I had the category of game that made me ugly cry.
Oh,
best game with owls in it. Oh, wait a minute.
That was Owlboy. Owlboy made me ugly cry.
Yes, there you go. Owlboy.
But yeah, next week is going to be, I don't know if it's going to be the last podcast of the year, but I know that, what's it called? 2 weeks from now is Christmas. So I don't think we're going to be recording a podcast on that day. So we may skip next week, the week after next for Christmas. And, actually what's funny is the podcast after that is going to be January 1st. So we will definitely record a podcast on January 1st. How often do you get to do that? The literal New Year's Day podcast. Hello, it's January 21st, 2018. So yeah, we need to get out our Games of the Year winners. And that's what we want you out there, for those of you who actually want to write in. Please let us know what your Games of the Year were. What your favorite games were, what the games you wanted to stuff into a toilet were. You know, the games with the best graphics. You know, and here's the thing. We're probably going to have, you know what? What game had the best music is going to be the question of this week. Because we already lightly touched on it earlier in the podcast. So we want to know from you, which game did you play had the best music in it? And there's a lot of nominees this year because there's a lot of games. And I'm not even thinking of Cuphead and Nier Automata. You know, you can think of Shadow of War had some excellent music. I know that Shadow of War might be winning game that made me misty-eyed the most, the ending.
Nice.
Yeah. Did you see the true ending for Shadow of War?
I did not.
Okay. If you knew anything about it's a sad, bittersweet ending. And if you knew anything about the Lord of the Rings mythos, it's even sadder and more bittersweet. Spoiler warning, Talion goes through shit in the final cutscene. Because it's inevitable. But on the other hand, you know, he gets what he wants at the same time. So, let me ask you, Scott, was there any endings in any games that you played this year that were emotional for you?
I haven't, the Minecraft story mode hasn't finished, but I've been liking those endings to each chapter because it felt like I was making real decisions that mattered to the story, so they felt emotionally invested in them. So that really, I'd like to say that one.
You know, that reminds me. I haven't talked about it much, but the second season of Batman has been really interesting, and I can see it's not headed toward a happy ending. And I'm not talking about not happy ending like Walking Dead, in which, you know, everything's hopeless. So of course you're not going to have a truly happy ending in any of those games. But I just mean one that's going to be like, oh, it's, yeah. Gonna be. How about you, TJ?
Misty-eyed endings,
or just emotional? It doesn't have to be. You know, I mean, they could be tears of joy as well as tears of sorrow.
But
you've been playing a lot of multiplayer games. I don't know how you get misty-eyed at, say, at the any ending of Destiny 2.
I would really have to think about it for a bit. I'm staring at one game that has had its moments, but it hasn't got me there yet. It's Hollow Knight, which came out in February of this year. Right. It was kind of like it's pretty dang close to my favorite platformer this year. It's got a lot of vibes of things I like about Owlboy and Ori and the Blind Forest. Just like a beautiful soundtrack, a beautiful story. Really interesting. And there are parts in it that have, like, make me get the feels.
Yeah. You know, it's too bad Inside was a 2016 game, because I really have to play that. I heard it has a batshit crazy ending, so... Anyway.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Anyways, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles and your feedback. So leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us some iTunes comments. I am on Twitter at Jonah Falcon.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
And I am at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you next week with our personal Games of the Year awards. So please write in and let us know what games you really liked or disliked this year.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Play games, have fun, be cool, y'all.